Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the Archbishop of Dublin responds to the release of a long-awaited report detailing thousands of cases of sexual abuse by priests over the past three decades. The Archbishop of Westminster shares some of the concerns that church leaders in England and Wales were discussing at their recent plenary assembly. And the next phase of Anglican-Catholic theological dialogue is scheduled to begin next autumn. The long-awaited Dublin Archdiocese Commission report into how allegations of child sex abuse by priests were handled by church and state authorities was published on Thursday by the Irish Minister for Justice and Minister of State for Children. The commission was set up in March 2006 to investigate abuse allegations against 46 priests who were active in the Archdiocese during the period from January 1975 to April 2000. As well as detailing thousands of cases of abuse, the report addresses how allegations against the priests were dealt with by four archbishops, who served as both chancellors and auxiliaries of the archdiocese over that three-decade period. This is the third inquiry in the last 4 years into child abuse by priests in Ireland. It comes on the heels of the Ryan report published earlier this year on abuse of children in religious-run state industrial schools. The Archdiocesan Commission expressed regret on Thursday that the report was not being published in full. Ireland's High Court ruled that the report had to omit names and references to any cases that are currently on trial.
This is a chapter in the history of the Archdiocese of Dublin, which is a sad chapter. It will remain there. You just can't deny that. And there's no point in saying, well, look, the report is over. It's been back to business as it was before. The church has to change. And I believe that we will be the better for having fully addressed this chapter.
Archbishop Dermot Martin took over from Cardinal Desmond Connell as head of the church in Dublin in April 2004. I asked him what message he has for all these sex abuse victims and their families.
I think of the horror that they went through. I think particularly of one group, that's people who have not yet been able to tell their story, and for whom reading this report will obviously awaken in them terrible emotions which they haven't been able to come to grips with. I, over the years, have met many, many victims, and I can see that in many ways their lives have been ruined, or part of their lives has been ruined. They've had to go and live with this terrible suffering over years. For them, it's better that they speak for themselves, but I can imagine for some the fact that the truth is coming out is very important.
Many of those people, and many people reading this report, are asking, how could the bishops and other church leaders fail to take action for so long? What is your answer to that?
It's obviously a question that you ask yourself. It's very hard to put yourself in the position of someone else. But one of the sad things is that the parents who came forward and the victims who came forward, they had no doubt about how serious this was. And most of them came forward basically to say, we don't want this to happen to somebody else. And many of them are grieving because they came forward too late, and they believe that because of that somebody else may have been abused. They had no doubts at all about the seriousness of it. And for somehow or other, you know, church leaders, they didn't seem to have that same sense of how disastrous this was for children.
Many of the priests, many of the abusers are in jail. Many of them have been brought to justice, if you like. Do you think there should be some way in which church leaders should take responsibility for this in a more open, more public way?
I think, you know, that on the publication of the report, people will take some, admit their responsibilities where they took place. Criminal responsibility, it's the task of the police to investigate and the director of public prosecutions to prosecute. But in many cases, these cases have been examined. There are also worries as to whether the law is adequate, the framework of law is adequate for the protection of children, and that the powers given to the health executive and to the police may not be adequate. One thing is that many of these abusers were at times in total denial, at times extremely devious. The problem was that decisions were taken, you know, not to treat their offences as seriously as they should. Maybe bishops were deceived. The problem is decisions were taken which permitted other children to be abused. Now, on the other hand, you know, it has to be said that a huge amount of progress has been made in Ireland into the application of child protection norms in the church. And it isn't simply about detecting, it's about protecting. I think, for example, in every parish now we have people who have got a responsibility to, it's not rocket science, it's common sense in many ways, to keep their eyes open, look out for behaviour on the part of a priest or anybody else in the parish which seems strange, worrying in their relationship with children. And not to get involved in investigating, but simply to get that, to tell the professionals where this is happening. I've heard very sad stories of people saying to me, what happened to me was actually, it was known that there was a problem in the parish, and people didn't seem to know how to deal with it. So that this type of ongoing safeguarding measures will be able to identify problematic behaviour at a much earlier stage, and to deal with that professionally, and to hopefully, it's not going to be possible ever to eliminate, but you have to do everything you can to make sure that risk is least.
What kind of long-term damage do you think has this done to the church in Dublin?
I can see that when there's talk about the abuse of children, parents think of their own children, and parents themselves will have had real difficulties of confidence in and the safety of allowing their children to take part in church activities. I think parents are extremely annoyed at the way that the abuse, knowledge about abuse was handled. They think in terms of their children, and there has been a real crisis of confidence on the part of many parents. You can't expect confidence to be rebuilt overnight. It's a question of rebuilding that, of showing that the measures are there, of clearly expressing not just regret and apologies, but in many ways shame about what happened. And I know from what I hear that parents want these strong protection measures to be applied and there to be no compromise.
On the other side, this has also taken a devastating toll on the morale of the priests in the Your Archdiocese, hasn't it? What can you do about that?
I think the priests, you know, when they day after day hear about this matter, it's like it's an aggression on their work, and it's very hard. The first thing is that they have to accept the fact that this happened, and there's also a tendency to go into denial, and to show everybody going forward that we are all working for a church in which children would be safe, to recognise that good child protection measures are good priest protection measures, and to go forward. The last thing this is a particular period when the church needs to enter into a new dialogue with young people, and it would be tragic if priests felt inhibited in that. You know, parishioners know and recognise good priests. And I believe from their own parishioners and lay people, those priests will get the courage and the strength to recognise how important their own mission is.
Finally, you came in as Archbishop of Dublin. You've been dealing with this for a number of years now. What kind of toll does it take on you personally?
You know, it can be very tiring, emotionally draining, when you listen. It isn't just listening to people telling their stories, but when you see what they've gone through. It can't but be emotionally draining. But you come in, you have to do a job, and that's it. I hope that we can now move on to the other tasks that at times may have been neglected a little bit during this. But this is a chapter in the history of the Archdiocese of Dublin, which is a sad chapter. It will remain there. You just can't deny that. And there's no point in saying, well, look, the report is over. It's been back to business as it was before. The church has to change, and I believe that we will be the better for having fully addressed this chapter. and we have to be very vigilant in our training of priests. But in the midst of all this, I've never lost my optimism that we are moving in the right direction.
My thanks there to Archbishop Dermot Martin, head of the Dublin Archdiocese since 2004. Catholic bishops in England and Wales held their regular plenary assembly in the northern city of Leeds last week. At the top of the agenda were concerns over changing attitudes to euthanasia in the UK, as well as discussions of the new apostolic constitution for groups of former Anglicans seeking to come into communion with Rome, and a nationwide initiative to support Christians in the Holy Land. Just after the meeting ended, Archbishop Vincent Nichols of Westminster, head of the Bishops' Conference, told me more about these key issues, beginning with the bishop's concern over guidelines from the Director of Public Prosecutions regarding cases of assisted suicide.
What the Director of Public Prosecutions has published is a consultation document. So we're very keen to play a good part in this process of consultation, and we hope that he will pay attention to the main points that we want to make before formulating his guidance. And our main concern is that the draft guidance could create the perception that in certain circumstances, assisting somebody to take their own life is no longer a crime. Now, that is, we fear, could be an unintended consequence of the guidance. Because, of course, the guidance is being offered within the context of an unchanged law in which to assist somebody to commit suicide is a crime. The issue is not whether it's criminal or not, but whether it's proper to prosecute or not. And we agree that the Director of Public Prosecution should have some leeway in this, but not as much as is indicated in the guidance.
Do you think the Church's voice will be heard clearly on this issue? How hopeful are you?
Well, some of our key objections, for example, that a factor which would make it less likely that a prosecution would follow is where the person, the victim, was disabled or terminally ill, or where the victim has a record of attempted suicide, or where the victim was a spouse or a partner or a close family member who has been involved in assisting the suicide. Now, we think this creates a category or three categories of people who have less protection of the law than others, and we think that's unjustified. And in fact, in the detail of each case, we go and make the argument. But we're not alone in this. This is very similar to the position being taken up by the Church of England, and we've worked closely with the Church of England over this, and also very similar to a major movement in this country now called Care Not Killing, which is supported by very eminent people. For example, Baroness Butler-Slosh, the ex-head of the Family Division, Lord Carlisle, Professor Sheila Holmes, the ex-president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, Lord Mackay, the former Lord Chancellor, Baroness Campbell, Baron McCall of Dulwich. These are not people associated with the Catholic Church and their stance, but their stance is the same as ours.
Are you concerned, though, that attitudes in Britain are shifting in favour of allowing, say, a close family member to assist someone with a disability, as you're suggesting?
Well, I think what we are involved in is the classic discussion that hard cases actually make bad laws. And we're not, as I say, objecting to the DPP having some leeway whether to decide to prosecute or not. But we think his initial draft guidance is too widely drawn. And there will be hard cases, and it's right that he has some leeway. But what we fear is this guidance will, as it were, accentuate the perception that assisting in the suicide is no longer a crime, and the law has not changed. And in the last 18 months, it's been discussed twice in Parliament, and on both occasions, changes in the law have been turned down by Parliament. So we do not want to see a shift in the perception of the reality of the law created through this guidance. In fact, it was the change in the reality of the law around assisting suicide that started the process in Holland or in the Netherlands of the actual law on euthanasia being changed. And we don't want to see this country going Dutch.
Moving on to another issue that you were looking at during that plenary, you've also been involved in the launch of a new charity, haven't you, to support Christians in the Holy Land. Tell us
yes,
a bit about
that. Well, it's a very important initiative. and it's called Friends of the Holy Land. And what we're really looking to do is capture that instinct for concern of the Holy Land that many people have, and especially those who have been there on pilgrimage. When people come back from pilgrimage, or when they're well informed about the situation of the Christian community in the Holy Land, they want to do something. And this new charity called Friends of the Holy Land will enable them to put that concern into practice. And it's looking, therefore, for groups to be formed right across the parishes of England and Wales, which will support the Christian community in those lands with their prayer, with practical measures, for example, helping the trade in olive-carved goods, and also offering them financial support for particular targeted charities. So we were very pleased to welcome the Latin patriarch, His Beatitude Fautual, to our meeting this week. He was able to speak firsthand to the realities that the Church in the Holy Land faces.
You've also been looking at the new apostolic constitution for groups of former Anglicans wishing to come into full communion with Rome. There are a lot of concerns, as you know, about the effect that this will have on the relations between the two churches. What are your views on it?
Well, we have focused here, as you would expect, on how the step that the Holy Father has taken might play out in England. And what we've remembered very clearly is that it has not been put in place particularly with England in mind, that the action that the Holy Father has taken is for the universal church, and therefore it has to be read carefully into any particular local situation. And so we here have been resolved that this will not change the broad-based ongoing cooperation and mutual commitment between the Church of England and the bishops of England and Wales. And we will put that into practice in a whole number of ways. The fact that we continue to work together on the DPP's guidance issue illustrates that our working relationship together goes on fine. And the fact that the Archbishop of Canterbury very, very graciously made sure that he and Bishop Christopher Hill, accompanied myself and Archbishop Kevin MacDonald, when we presented the Apostolic Constitution to the press, we did that together. And it was recognized, and Bishop Christopher Hill expressed this in this way. He said, this is a step of great pastoral concern for those who risk floating off into ecclesiolas, was his phrase, little independent churches, should not do so, and should find pastoral care and ecclesial identity within the Catholic Church, in the visible communion of the Catholic Church. It's very hard for us to know what the response will be in England, because, of course, we have been looking at what happens when particularly clergy of the Church of England want to come into full communion with the Catholic Church, and they are welcomed. But this initiative, this step by the Holy See, is about groups of people. It's not about groups of clergy, it's about groups of people, maybe with their clergy. And it's difficult to see that happening in any measurable, significant scale at this moment in England.
My thanks there to Archbishop Vincent Nichols of Westminster, head of the Bishops' Conference in England and Wales. And to find out more on all those stories, you can see the Bishop's website at www.catholicchurch.org.uk. As a follow-up to the meeting of Pope Benedict and the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, on Saturday, at which both leaders reaffirmed their desire to strengthen ecumenical relations, theologians from the two churches met this week to prepare the third phase of the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, or ARCIC as it's commonly called. At the one-day meeting on Monday, the group discussed possible dates, participants, and an agenda for this new round of talks, which are expected to begin sometime next autumn.
Together with a new phase of ARCIC, we will be considering how to further the reception of the ARCIC documents within the life of the Church.
Among those most closely involved in these discussions is Monsignor Mark Langham, in charge of Catholic-Anglican relations at the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity.
Archic, as you know, is the official dialogue between the Roman Catholic Church and the Anglican Communion, which took its inspiration from the meeting of Archbishop Ramsay of Canterbury and Pope Paul VI in 1966. That meeting was reaffirmed in 1982 when the Holy Father came to England, and at Canterbury a joint declaration was made affirming the work of Archic, and the second phase then began. And now we're looking towards a third phase of that same dialogue, looking at deepening our relationship, at revisiting some of the issues and looking at some of the new issues that have arisen in the meantime.
What kind of issues are likely to be on the agenda at this third round of talks? Because the Archbishop of Canterbury here in Rome was suggesting some quite challenging ideas around the possible ordination of women, the exercise of papal primacy. Are these likely to show up on the agenda?
They will naturally occur within the agenda, but that's not our starting point. Our starting point will be the broader question of the relationship between the universal church and the local church. That's something that both of us are challenged by, and both of us can also investigate very fruitfully. And then within that context, we're able to look at particular issues that have arisen within the Anglican Communion in recent years, the ordination of women, the relationship of same-sex marriages to the church's discipline, the ordination of practicing homosexuals. We're able to look at those issues within the broader context. And also, there are a lot of positive things that we can say to each other about that issue.
Do you have yet a time frame when the talks may begin?
We have no fixed time frame yet, but it is our hope that within the next year, perhaps towards the end of next year, we will be able to formally to restart the third phase of Archic. We need to find theologians, we need to set our teams up, we need to establish where we're going to meet and the frequency of meetings. We have all these in at the planning stage, but we need to finalise those details. But it's very much our hope within the year that we will be starting the new phase.
There are critics who question the validity of these talks, saying that perhaps face-to-face meetings between the Pope and the Archbishop of Canterbury are much more important, or even grassroots work is much more important. What do you say to them?
Archic itself recognises that there are various levels to ecumenical encounter, at the highest level between the Holy Father and the Archbishop of Canterbury. At local level, at parish level, wonderful encounters take place, and they have benefited from the work of commissions like Archic, where theologians speak together. The work of theologians dialoguing, addressing some of the most critical issues in relationship between our churches is essential, but we do realise it's not the whole story, and Archic itself recommends that other elements take place. The IARCM, the international meeting between bishops of Roman Catholic Church and Anglican Communion, is perhaps looking at a wider range of encounters, how we can meet at parish level, how leadership can help in receiving these agreements, how we can, as Roman Catholics and Anglicans, work together at all sorts of levels. So Archic takes place within a much wider framework, but its work is essential. The theological engagement between the two communions is an essential part of that broader picture.
Monsignor Mark Langham is in charge of the Catholic Church's relations with Anglicans and Methodists at the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. Meanwhile, one of the most significant Catholic promoters of the ecumenical movement throughout the past century, Cardinal Johannes Willebrands, was honoured at a conference here in Rome last week at the Gregorian University. Among the speakers at the one-day colloquium last Thursday was the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, and the current president of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, Cardinal Walter Kasper. A key figure at the Second Vatican Council and one of the first to encourage the Catholic Church's opening to other Christian traditions, Willebrands died in 2006 at the age of 96, at that time the oldest member of the College of Cardinals. Archbishop of Utrecht from 1975 to 83, he's best remembered as a skilled diplomat with a sharp sense of humour who pioneered closer contacts with the Orthodox and Protestant worlds.
It was not easy at all. Willebrands personally had to work very hard to try to convince bishops that this was a very important thing to do.
Capuchin Father William Hen was another of the speakers at the one-day colloquium. I asked him more about the Dutch cardinal's legacy to the ecumenical movement, in particular his close contacts with the Geneva-based World Council of Churches.
Well, I would say that precisely because of his personal relations and interest in the work of the World Council, he was able at an initial stage to clear up misunderstandings, to begin to establish in an informal way contacts, and that was absolutely necessary to reach then the point of more formal institutional contacts between the Vatican and the World Council. For Willebrands, the World Council was an effect of the work of the Holy Spirit in the Church, and he felt it was extremely important for the Roman Catholic Church to be in collaboration and, well, he used the word fraternal solidarity with the World Council.
This was a view that wasn't necessarily very popular in Rome to begin with, was it? You talk about his work as a conversion of the Catholic Church itself towards this ecumenical dialogue.
Well, that's quite true. I'm not sure if he came up with the idea of conversion, but some others, like, for example, Congar, would say that at Vatican II there was, you could almost see kind of a movement toward ecumenism by the many bishops. But right, well, the ecumenism had some intrinsic kind of dangers, I'd say, for the Catholic Church. There was the fear that that perhaps it would mean a kind of a relativism, that all churches are equal. And the popes and the leaders in the Vatican felt that we really, and we still feel that, we just needed to avoid that. So how do you enter into full collaboration with and kind of avoid what could be dangers? That was the problem. And I think he was one who, by his personal relationships, his wisdom, was able to help the church resolve those issues.
We think of the cardinal as a pioneer in this ecumenical work between the different Christian churches. We've also been hearing about him as a pioneer of the relationship between Christians and Jews, a new relationship between Christians and Jews.
No, that's true. And I'd say his experiences, I believe, during the Second World War, when his country was occupied and over 100,000 Jews were put to death, was a formative experience for him. I think his collaboration with Cardinal Bea was very significant here. Bea was intensely interested in the Catholic Church saying something to really recognize our kinship with the Jewish people and the relation between Christianity and Judaism. So I'd say together they worked very hard, and it was a difficult task in a way, I think, because of the Catholic Church is so big, and so in different parts of the world you have to be attentive to how something is going to be received. And that was really the great difficulty with the declaration with regard to the other religions and including Judaism. But yes, it was a very important step forward, and it was not easy at all. Willebrands personally had to work very hard to try to convince bishops that this was a very important thing to do, to be positive, have a positive statement about the Jews.
Thanks there to Capuchin Father William Hen, a professor at the Gregorian University. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.